from the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
With identity politics, there is the scapegoat, the white heterosexual male, but there's no forgiveness and no grace whatsoever. There's just the eternal and unpayable debt, much like Adam's original sin, that the white man owes the rest.
This is your host, Scott Bertram, and that's Joshua Mitchell, author of American Awakening, Identity, Politics, and Other Afflictions of Our Time. We'll talk in length a bit later on in the program with Joshua Mitchell about that book. First, we're joined by John J. Miller, director of the Dow Journalism Program at Hillsdale College. John, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Scott.
Speaking today a bit about former President Ronald Reagan, the great communicator, his nickname, and a little about his journalism radio career, which started very early on, before the movies. Indeed, his radio career of Ronald Reagan started very early in his life.
It was his first job out of college, before Hollywood, before politics, before all of that. Ronald Reagan graduated from Eureka College, this little liberal arts school in the middle of Illinois. I love that name, by the way, Eureka College. What a name. And the town is called Eureka, but it's right near Peoria. That's where Ronald Reagan went to college. And when he finished college, his first job was at WOC, the radio station in Davenport, Iowa, which is part of the Quad Cities. So two of them are in Iowa, two of them are in Illinois. And it's a two-state metropolitan area.
It's still around.
So WOC got a job there, and he was a sports broadcaster there. And one of the things he did is he covered Chicago Cubs games for listeners way out there. And this is in about 1932. And they did a little bit different back then, which is they didn't have the technology to broadcast a game from the booth at Wrigley Field. You know, mm-hmm. Now when you listen to a game at Wrigley Field or Comerica Park for the Tigers or whatever, you're listening to a play-by-play guy and a color commentator who are in a booth right behind home plate telling you what's going on. In Davenport, Iowa, they couldn't do that. They didn't have the technology to do that. So what they would get is that the guy in the studio in Davenport would, by telegraph, get a report on what's happening, kind of a live report on what's happening at the ballpark, and he would then narrate the story of the game.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd have to invent a lot of details, obviously, but as he's doing it, he's, you know, telling you what's going on, you know. Strike, ball, you know, ground out to first, home run, you know, rounds the bases and heads to home. And you can see where there's a bit of a storytelling element that comes into this, and how a guy who goes on to become someone, as you say, was known as the great communicator, how this medium would force you to become a storyteller.
I imagine with those telegraphs, there was opportunities for problems along the way.
So it was not a real easy job, right?
Yeah.
I mean, when everything was working well, it was still a difficult job. You know, how do you fill the silence with your imagination and still tell a basically accurate story about what's going on? Well, Reagan loved to tell a story about what was, I'm sure, in the moment, a harrowing incident, which is in the middle of a game, the telegraph link went out. And so, you know, there was a batter at the plate, game, you know, middle of the game, and suddenly the report stopped coming. You know, I suppose you could have stopped and said, I'm sorry, we're having technical difficulties, but Reagan just kept on going. And I'm gonna read a quote about how he described the incident one time. I think this is from his autobiography, maybe a speech he gave. At any rate, this is how he described what happened. Again, 1932, he's covering the Cubs game. Quote, there were several other stations broadcasting that game, and I knew I'd lose my audience if I told them we'd lost our telegraph connections, so I took a chance. I had Billy Jurgis hit another foul. Then I had him foul one that only missed being a home run by a foot. I had him foul one back in the stands and took up some time describing the two lads that got in a fight over the ball. I kept on having him foul balls until I was setting a record for the ball player hitting successive foul balls, and I was getting more than a little scared. Just then my operator started typing. When he passed me the paper, I started to giggle. It said, Jurgis popped out on the first ball pitch. So it's, and by the way, is that not a great story?
Yeah.
Right? And so this storyteller, this great communicator, you know, learned how to do it at this radio station, and then he had this gem of a story, which you know, you wouldn't want to live through and fake your way through necessarily, but what a great story it is now.
John J. Miller talking with us about Ronald Reagan. The you know, he grew up in Dixon, small town in Illinois, went to a small college in Eureka. Radio career in Davenport, which Quad Cities, again, is maybe a medium market in this day and age. There had to be some opportunities for him that he would not have received if he were in a larger city, went to a larger college.
Well, he always thought that Eureka gave him a bunch of advantages, partly because it was so small. Now, he went there not because he was attracted to this great school that had recruited them. He went there because he was following a girl. His girlfriend wanted to go to Eureka, so he followed her there. She dumped him eventually, but there he was at Eureka, and he played sports. And he always said Eureka and its smallness was important because it forced every student into a variety of leadership roles. You couldn't be just, you know, another member of a large group. You couldn't sit back and do that. If you got involved in anything, you almost by definition had to lead it.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were leadership opportunities at clubs. There were roles in the stage plays that they would put on, all kinds of things like that. And he said, this was really important to me as a young man to have these opportunities that I then went on to build upon. I suppose Reagan was probably a natural leader, right? Probably a lot of this came to him naturally, but also was developed at this college. And he said, I mean, this is what he said. He says another school would maybe not have done that for me.
When we get to the 1970s, well, when you go past that, you're president, you have speechwriters, people who are helping you to craft the words and find the message. But in the 1970s, Ronald Reagan was doing radio commentaries in which he was writing the scripts himself and then delivering those scripts to an audience. This is an opportunity for him to sort of prove that he's not just an actor and he's not just someone reading someone else's scripts. He's doing this himself and finding an audience.
I love that story because this was a criticism of him in the 1980s that he's just this dumb actor. You put a script in front of him and he'll perform it real well, but he didn't write it. And of course, Reagan was blessed with some really great speechwriters. I mean, you know, Peggy Noonan is still around and doing great work at the Wall Street Journal. Peter Robinson, there are many others who contributed to an administration, a presidency that was full of great words and great speeches. But behind it all was Reagan, who really was a great communicator. And one of the best ways we see that is through his work in radio in the 1970s. And after he was governor of California and was running for president, thinking about running again for president, you know, what does a guy like that do? You know, you can't go back to GE, to your old job. You can't go back to Hollywood. So after he was governor of California and then running for president, thinking about running for president again, what does a guy like that do with his time? Well, you know, running for president is a full-time job, but you can't go back to GE. You can't go back to Hollywood. What do you do? One of the things Ronald Reagan did is that he wrote weekly radio commentaries. And so he every week, He would deliver a short commentary about what was happening in the United States or in the world. This was obviously, you know, during the Cold War. A lot of his commentaries had to do with the Soviet Union and the importance of the Cold War and so on. But he wrote these radio commentaries and delivered them. And they were sort of forgotten after he did it because, again, you know, broadcast, you know, words like that, they just kind of vanish into the ether. Well, he wrote them all out. Longhand. And after he was president, people remembered that he'd done this. They went into the archives and they found that you know, all these radio commentaries that he wrote out himself.
John J. Miller, director of the Dow Journalism Program here at Hillsdale College, talking about Ronald Reagan, the great communicator and partially his radio career as well. John, thanks for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thanks, Scott. My pleasure.
Up next, we talk with Joshua Mitchell about his latest book, American Awakening, Identity, Politics, and Other Afflictions of Our Time. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. For information about Hillsdale College for potential students, for friends of the college, or alumni, head to hillsdale.edu. We're joined now by Joshua Mitchell, professor of political theory at Georgetown University, author of numerous journal articles and four books, including the most recent one, American Awakening, Identity, Politics, and Other Afflictions of Our Time. Joshua, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Scott. Thank you for having me.
This is such an important book, and it's clearly a well-written and well-thought book. Let's begin our conversation, though, by defining that term that's in your subhead, which is identity politics. We've talked about it here on the show previously, and others have read about it elsewhere. How do you think about, how do you define identity politics?
Well, it has two meanings, and the first one is fairly innocuous and leads to confusion. So, you know, 30 years ago, we would say things like, I was an American, or I am an American, or I'm this or I'm that. And now, for some reason, everybody has to put that predicate on. My identity is American. And that's very interesting. And as a substitute for what I call kind, that's fine. I'm not troubled by that. I think it's unnecessary, but I'm not troubled by it. But identity politics has another meaning, and this is the one that has the valence with us today. And it, in this meaning, it's really, it's not a kind, it's a relationship. And so you say, I'm a black American, I'm a woman, I'm gay, I'm transgender, and that's a signal. It's a signal that specifies your relationship to what I call, or to who I call, the prime transgressor. Because the scheme of identity politics requires a prime transgressor or a scapegoat. In this way, it's derivative of Christianity. We can talk about that. But when you say, I have this identity or that, you're signaling your relationship to the prime transgressor, and you're signaling that you actually deserve what I call innocence points. And there's a whole scheme called intersectionality, which specifies how many innocence points you have, and that's really the game afoot these days, is to specify your innocence with respect to the prime transgressor. That's how identity politics is really used today.
And you talk about in the book there is this danger with identity politics and how they manifest itself, and we see this in so many places, of a society, a culture that does not value grace or forgiveness, and one in which we all apparently now will be defined by our worst moment or our worst act in our lives with no help of forgiveness or no hope of redemption. Is that a dangerous place to be?
Yeah, so you know, I mentioned a few minutes ago that this is a derivative and a deeply perverse derivative of Christianity. The Christian understanding is that we're all broken and that we were all so broken that we couldn't heal ourselves, and so God had to send himself into the world, and God was the innocent victim, the scapegoat, who took upon himself the sins of the world so that we all may be freed. And so we receive grace, we receive forgiveness for our transgressions. Now, with identity politics, there is the scapegoat, the white heterosexual male, but there's no forgiveness and no grace whatsoever. There's just the eternal and unpayable debt. And where this goes then is eventually once the prime transgressor is purged or sent out into silence, or whether we teach a whole generation of boys that they're worthless and so go play video games or watch pornography or whatever, what happens is once that prime transgressor is purged, you have to find another transgressor. The Christian formula was there's one sufficient scapegoat who takes away the sins of the world, and there's no more necessary scapegoating or purging. It's an extraordinary formula in its implication. But that's not what identity politics does. It has to continually purge a scapegoat because it offers an imminent resolution to the problem rather than a transcendent resolution to the problem of sin. And so after the white man is purged, probably, is my guess, it's a reasonably good one, it doesn't take much to figure this out, the next will be white women, and we already can see the Karen meme starting to emerge.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think, irony of ironies, it will be black heterosexual males. Why? Because when you move farther along in the identity politics logic and get to transgenderism, the only way this group of innocent victims can be hallowed is if we all admit our sin of heteronormativity and adherence to a homophobic church. And so we have to get rid of people who believe that. And so, well, what this means now is that the whole enterprise of starting with the innocent victim of African Americans in the 60s, and I'm happy to talk about race when we get there, the whole enterprise then ends by purging the black heterosexual male who believes in the family and the church. So there's something deeply perverse about this arrangement.
Joshua Mitchell is with us. His book, American Awakening, Identity, Politics, and Other Afflictions of Our Time. You identify three afflictions that keep us from pursuing the noble idea that citizens can work together to build a common world, which is what America has always been committed to. The first is identity politics, which we've talked about for a while. The second affliction you describe as citizens that are sort of oscillating, going back and forth between this feeling of being invincible and this feeling of being impotent. What is the consequences to that? Why is that a problem?
So I dare to take from the psychologists and brain chemists terms that they have cornered and see them in philosophical ways. So the first term, the second portion of the book, it's a shortish section, is on bipolarity and manic depression. And the third is on addiction, but I give it a deeper philosophical rendering. With respect to bipolarity, my argument is that if you look at the history of Western political thought, you see that there's been an understanding that the human soul is unstable and oscillates back and forth between these incredible highs and lows. I find it in Augustine, so kind of beginning in Augustine. Actually, I think it's there even in Plato in Book 9 of the Republic when he discusses the tyrannical soul, who is both master and slave and oscillates back and forth between the two.
Mm-hmm.
But Augustine is, I think, the first person who sees this fully. It's in the Confessions. And he says that there is no rest until I rest in thee. I won't bore you with the whole list within the history of political philosophy of people who have seen this, but Tocqueville's formulation, again, long before the physiologist wanted to say that this is a brain chemistry problem that the pharmaceutical industry alone can solve, Tocqueville said, toward the end of Democracy in America, he said, I foresee a day in America where its citizens will come to see themselves as greater than kings and less than men. And his account of this was that it was caused by the breaking of the links that happened as you move from the aristocratic age to the democratic age. In the aristocratic age, we're held fast by our rules and reciprocal obligations. And as sociologists have been commenting for the last couple hundred years, all those links get broken with modernity. We become isolated and alone. And so the breaking of the linkage ends up producing two different psychic phenomena. By virtue of having no connections,
mm-hmm.
we can come to feel ourselves to be sovereign selves who hover over the world and can cancel anybody who we don't like on our Facebook page. And yet also by virtue of being delinked, we feel ourselves utterly alone.
We'll pause right there. Back for more with Joshua Mitchell, author of American Awakening, Identity, Politics, and Other Afflictions of Our Time. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
What is happening in the state of Jefferson? To find out, listen to the Jefferson State of Mind program Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. on KCNR with your hosts Wayne Carpenter and Terry Raposa. To catch up on past broadcasts or to listen anytime, go to KCNR1460.com and click on the archives link.
ACA, come out and play. Have you seen the bill we all have to pay? The time has come for 51 in a Jefferson state of mind.
Hey guys, I'm Bob the Drop. Welcome to my podcast. Do you like water? If you do, you're going to love me. I'm pure and simple. I'm talking refreshing. Yeah. Spent 500 years in a glacier. The boy was that cold. I never was and never will be tap water. Nope. Bottled at the source, the base of Mount Shasta. Yep, pure and simple. Naturally the best. You can try me by calling 1-800-922-6227. Mount Shasta Spring Water.
At Shasta Regional Medical Group, We're focused on the health matters that matter to you, like having a primary care doctor you trust. Our physicians put patients first. They take the time to listen to your needs and concerns, and they provide the information you need to make good decisions about your own health. At Shasta Regional Medical Group, you have an integrated network of caregivers and specialists working to serve you in a compassionate, patient-centered environment. We're conveniently located right across the street from Shasta Regional Medical Center. To make an appointment, call Shasta Regional Medical Group today at 605-4260 or visit us online at ShastaRegionalMedicalGroup.com. Shasta Regional Medical Group. Your primary care is our primary concern.
Hey, Redding, guess what? Our dining room at Black Bear Diner is open again, and we're bringing chili back. That's right. Come dine in comfort inside of our Hilltop Drive location. And special for March, ask for a bowl or cup of our delicious homemade chili or try one of our new chili creations, a chili stuffed breakfast burrito, a chili cheddar cheeseburger, or for dinner, our tri-tip chili platter. Come dine inside or order for takeout at blackbeardiner.com.
Black Bear Diner.
Zip on over to Drip, now open at 2766 Falls Ferry Road in Anderson, next to Anytime Fitness. Drip features healthy and delicious drinks and shakes. Drip offers energy teas packed with antioxidants, delicious full meal replacement shakes, coffee loaded with protein, power oats, energy drinks, and so much more. Drip is open Monday through Friday from 7 to 7 and weekends 8 to 4. Stop by today, 2766 Falls Ferry Road in Anderson. Zip on over to Drip.
The Shasta County Grand Jury is now seeking applications for new members. The Grand Jury is a historic institution that investigates government and responds to citizen complaints on government issues, ensuring transparency and accountability among local government officials and agencies. Applications are being accepted until April 30th, with an informational Zoom meeting on April 21st at 3 p.m. Visit ShastaCountyGrandJury.org for more information and to get the meeting link. Help ensure government transparency. Join today.
If you don't ask the tough questions, who will?
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. We've been talking with Joshua Mitchell, author of American Awakening, Identity Politics and Other Afflictions of Our Time. Has our response as a society to COVID and the lockdowns and the loneliness and the issues that have spun out of that, how has that advanced your thoughts on the topic of this bipolar fashion of Americans now between invincible and impotent?
Well, the very first thing I wrote in the aftermath, or as soon as we started going to serious lockdown, was on this very issue. Tocqueville writes, "A tyrant will forgive citizens for not loving him, provided they do not love each other." So the very best way to guarantee the kinder and gentler despotism at the end of history is through social distancing. And I wrote in that very short essay, I think it's in Real Clear Politics, I wrote that that there are many ways to die. You can forestall death of the human body, but you can also, by forestalling that, you can advance political death.
Mm-hmm.
And my concern now is that after an initial flurry of resistance to the Zoom world that we're dwelling in now, a lot of people have become so comfortable with it that they're going to be unable and maybe even unwilling to step back into real social life. I see this with my students. I've been now teaching my Georgetown students for a year. Many of them have become incredibly fragile. And many of them look much more unhealthy than they did when they started.
Mm-hmm.
There's weight gain. I'm sure we've all noticed this. We're completely disconnected from a world of other people, which allows our imagination to wander. And I think that's part of the reason the political polarization has gotten incredibly worse in the last year, and why there's this oscillation back and forth between in the minds and souls of American citizens between utter compliance to the COVID regime and a kind of devil be damned, I'm going to go without a mask. We oscillate here back and forth between radical independence and radical submission. And this is not a healthy human situation.
Joshua Mitchell with us, the book American Awakening. The third affliction that you discuss in the book is the desire by Americans to, as you describe it, find these cheap shortcuts to life that sort of avoid the labor inherent in living. What are we missing when we avoid that labor, that struggle in our lives?
So the way I've put this in the book is I call it the disease of substitutism, and that sounds a bit awkward, so let me explain it. In the Republic, in book 3 and 4, and also in Rousseau's First Discourse, there's a very, very interesting idea about supplements being turned into substitutes. And the way Rousseau puts it, he says, the ancient warriors had courage, the modern warriors only have strength. And what he says there, what he means to say, is that there is this very difficult thing to develop called courage. And if a warrior who is courageous puts a weapon on, adds a weapon, his courage is able to be amplified. And the weapon is a supplement. But he worries, and now I come to the word shortcut, he worries that the modern world is all going to be about shortcuts. And so rather than developing the requisite courage, we're going to look for the shortcut of just putting on more and more weapons. And our answer is, our modern answer is going to be, well, we don't need to develop the competence of courage. Let's just get bigger and bigger weapons. And Rousseau's answer is, you've misunderstood the relationship between supplements and substitutes. That a weapon as a supplement to courage is a remarkable thing. But as a substitute, it will not work. And probably in our own everyday lives, the best analogy would be the meal and the vitamins. So you have a meal, and that's great, and it takes hard work to make a meal, and occasionally you might need a supplement, you might need vitamins. And they can enhance your strength. They can feed on the meal, so to speak, and amplify its effect. You can try the, you know, protein supplement powders, what will happen is somewhere along the line, the thought will come into your head, well, why do I have to spend the time making a meal? Why don't I just live on these protein powders? I mean, everybody, I did it as a weightlifter when I was in my 40s. I mean, it is such a remarkable temptation. And Rousseau's warning is that, and it's confirmed by what every weightlifter knows, Rousseau's warning is that, this will not end well, because you always have to have the meal first, and then you can have the supplement.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now let's extend this. I say in the book, I list a whole host of things that seem to be unrelated, but in fact are. The opioid addiction, fast food, Facebook friends, driverless cars, online shopping, the quest to have digital be a substitute for analog, and there are any number of other ones that you can raise. And they all seem unrelated, but in fact, driverless cars is another great one. They're not. They're all related. They're all attempts to avoid the really hard work of becoming a noble and decent human being.
Final question for Joshua Mitchell on American Awakening. We've talked about some discouraging things during the conversation today, but you do give us hope for the future in American Awakening. What are the brightest signs you see that this can be turned around?
What I increasingly say to everyone who's endorsing identity politics, who's not troubled by this bipolar oscillation between being kings and Western men, and by these, you know, immensely promising but ultimately pathological things like social media and online shopping, I ask them one question: how's that working for you? And it's a silly question, but it's actually the right question to ask. Because I think when people are honest with you, they'll say, well, on the one hand, life seems to be great, but there's this gnawing emptiness inside that you know, maybe we shouldn't be treating each other as simply identity categories and scoring each other on our intersectionality score. Maybe to be a human being requires more than that. Maybe it's not okay to oscillate back and forth between this feeling of immense powerlessness and impotence. And maybe all the drugs in the world I'm taking for that aren't going to really solve my problem. Maybe Facebook promises much, but why do I go to sleep feeling so empty? So the good good news, to kind of channel Rod Dreher, is that, you can't live by lies forever. And I think the numbness that people are feeling is some confirmation. And so rather than, attacking, and, there's certainly grounds to attack all these various, pathologies that we're seeing, I think we have to just ask people, how's that really working for you? So that's one thing I do. The other thing is, but that's one hopeful sign, is that people, and if you really press them, they're not happy with this. But then the other thing, I think is, African Americans. I think I work very closely with Bob Woodson, who's done the great work in the Woodson Center, and more recently in 1776 Unites. I think African Americans are going to be the key here, at least as a political group, because they know that family and the churches are necessary. This is the post-slavery, and even the slavery experience confirmed this for them. And this is inscribed in the DNA of 80% of African Americans. And for the Democratic Party to say to African Americans, as they are now doing, get to the back of the bus, the Rosa Parks reference I'm making here, get to the back of the bus, there's now a more important group of innocent victims, the transgendered Americans who you can only respect by renouncing your heteronormativity. This is not going to work. And I think, the African American community is the only one in America that can now say to the people in the Democratic Party who are fomenting this identity politics, no, we're not going to do this. It is not the case that civil rights goes to women's rights, goes to gay rights, goes to transgender rights, which is the exact argument the left is making.
Joshua Mitchell. American Awakening is the book, Identity Politics and Other Afflictions of Our Time. Joshua Mitchell again. American Awakening is the book. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Why, thank you to you, Scott. It's been great talking to you.
Up next, Ben Beyer from Hillsdale's Education Department joins us once again to continue his occasional series on definition. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
KCNR, 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and online at am1460.com. Don't miss Free Fire Radio weekday mornings from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. with Carl and Linda Bott. From 9 to noon, be informed and laugh along with Armstrong and Getty, the conscience of the nation. From noon to 3, find your financial peace with Dave Ramsey. From 3 to 6, don't miss constitutional expert Mark Levin. Monday through Thursday night, starting at 6 p.m., we have local shows featuring everything from the paranormal to riding routes, pop culture, and unsung heroes in the North State. From 7 to 10, tune into Ben Shapiro with an expanded program that brings the issues of the day to your radio. KCNR also has an incredible weekend lineup, including The Plotline, Jefferson State of Mind, Sovereign Minds, and We the People on KCNR 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and online at kcnr1460.com.
This is RC from Tobacco and Brew, bringing you this month's Cigar of the Humidor. For this month, we're reviewing Arturo Fuente's Hemingway Classic. With curves of a supermodel, this Perfecto has a superbly balanced, toothy, and attenuated Cameroon wrapper and pairs exquisitely with a complex filler and binder that indulges the palate with citrus, coffee, cocoa, and cedar. Come down to the shop for your Arturo Fuente Hemingway Classic today, 2143 Hilltop Drive, Reading.
March is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, and there is no better time to get screened than right now. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, colorectal cancer screenings have declined by 86%, and as a result, up to 10,000 more deaths are projected over the next decade. With early detection, colon cancer has a 90% survival rate, and it may even be preventable with a colonoscopy. At Reading Endoscopy Center, our number one priority is the health and safety of our patients, and our center has always been committed to maintaining strict infection control and prevention protocols. Schedule your colonoscopy today by calling us at 530-246-7000 or visiting readingendoscopy.com. Visit readingendoscopy.com.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. You can get an email every time there's a new episode of this show. Go to radiohour.hillsdale.edu and enter your email address, radiohour.hillsdale.edu. We're joined by Dr. Benjamin Beyer, Associate Professor of Education at Hillsdale College. Dr. Beyer, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Continuing our occasional series on definition with Dr. Beyer, and today we move into the realm of non-technical definitions.
That's right.
So where do we begin?
Well, that's a great question. So we're ultimately aspiring to being able to offer definitions that get at the very essence or nature of a thing. But prior to that, there's a lot that language can teach us about definition. And so maybe the very first thing to say is in a view of you know, Aristotelian philosophy, upon which much of what I'm saying is based, words are conventional, right? They're merely customary. Somebody at some point, right, just made up this word and coined it. But for Aristotle and Aristotelians, words can adequately express our thoughts about things, right? Words can really speak truth, can say of what is that it is. Mm-hmm. Not perfectly, you know, it's not mathematical. There's going to be gray areas, but it's an instrument that can work. But the fact that language is conventional or made up means that all of these definitions that rely upon what's sort of stamped into the language, right, they're pretty fallible. And yet, all of those conventions or customs can carry with them a lot of tradition and insight, because the person who first named something, right, did so to express his or her understanding. Mm-hmm. Like, say that we had no word for artifact. And so now we've got all of these various artifacts, but no name for them, and so the paleontologist, you know, comes, I call these artifacts, and perhaps he or she has in mind, you know, the Latin, you know, arte facio, to make with skill. Mm-hmm. Right, these antiquities were made with skill, and so that's how I've understood them. I'm going to name them as such, and in fact, right, in spite of that namer's fallibility, that's insightful. Like there's a good sort of carried along in there.
What about synonyms? How do they enter the equation here?
Yeah, so, you know, I think if you ask somebody for a definition, the first thing that they'd likely do is go to the dictionary. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not all dictionary definitions are synonyms, but most dictionary definitions are. You know, what is a human being? A person, a man.
Right.
You know, and so that's... that's about as good as when we try to understand a thing through pointing. You know, maybe you're with your friend out, you know, outside, and our example previously was trees. You know,
right.
So your friend doesn't know what a tree is, and you know, what is a tree? And you point, you know, it's that, and you're pointing at a particular evergreen tree. And the great limitation there is, well, that image might not suggest that this thing that doesn't have pine needles is also a tree, but in fact this maple is also a tree. So the pointing, sometimes people say ostensive definitions are pointed out. A synonym basically does the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Man, the human being, it's a person. You're pointing, so, right, if you collect a whole bunch of synonyms, maybe those start to help you understand what you're after, but it's going to be pretty limited. It's not getting at, right, what the thing is.
What if we branch out then to comparisons? This thing is like something else. We'd call them metaphors.
Yeah, excellent. So metaphors are really insightful. So, you know, for instance, if I say, you know, Achilles was a lion, or you know, Dr. Arne of Hillsdale College is a Socrates. You know, those are both instances of metaphor. And metaphor works by taking two apparently dissimilar things and holding them up with one another to reveal an unexpected connection, right? So what's the unspoken thing between connecting Achilles and the lion, like strength, ferocity, mm-hmm. Lordship, something, you know, rule of the jungle or of the myrmidons? What's similar between Dr. Arne and Socrates, you know, sort of a quick and challenging wit, wisdom, virtue, whatever it might be.
Very handsome, right. Too, we should point out.
Indeed. You know, Socrates was well known for being snub-nosed and bald and short, so I'll let listeners draw their own conclusions about that. But so we get, right, a real connection, a real insight, and the great thing about metaphor is, right, it's almost immediate or intuitive, mm-hmm. You know, John Donne calls the human being a piece of continent when he's trying to talk about how we're social, right? That we're connected with others. And so the person who's hearing the metaphor sort of spontaneously sees the connection and delights in that. And we're really moving forward, right? Man is a continent. Well, there is something about humans that they're communal or social in a way that a lot of other animals seem not to be. So there's some real progress beyond just the dictionary or the synonym here.
Mm-hmm. Talking with Dr. Benjamin Beyer, Associate Professor of Education at Hillsdale College, about definition, this time non-technical definitions. If we are acting to define something by what it is like, can we turn that around and say what they are not like, a negative definition, so to speak?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, of all the things we'll talk about today, I think this one actually sort of draws closest to these, you know, even better or more insightful forms of definition. Because, right, when you say that, you know, the blind person does not have sight, right, or that, you know, the human being is not a fierce wild animal, we're not comparing dissimilar things like Achilles and the lion. Like we're talking about real things, mm-hmm. And say, like, well, it's not this. And Thomas Aquinas says when we see a thing's opposite, that helps us understand what the thing is, right? So by seeing what it's not and kind of cutting that away, it's actually shedding light on the thing, so that, right, you know, and actually this involves metaphor too, but John Donne, right, before he says man is a piece of continent, he says no man is an island, right? So that, and that's the more famous line, especially maybe through Thomas Merton in the 20th century. So, right, there about when you say what someone is not, that can really shed light on what someone is.
And finally, for this particular discussion, what about etymological aspects?
Yeah, so, you know, while what we were just talking about with the negative definitions maybe gets closest to real definitions and explains the continuing endurance of why people have opposite books that children delight in, and the etymological one, I'd say, maybe carries the most sort of common wisdom and history within it. You know, our example before of artifact, to just talk about how we name, right? We name as we understand, and then we understand as we have named. Well, we were understanding that by seeing the Latin roots of the English artifact. But to take just one more example, the word community has, right, in its etymology, again, sort of a Latinate origin of communere. And so that's something like with or within walls. Mm. And so, right, if we're trying to understand what a community is, it's that where people are, you know, as the word suggests, like physically gathered together,
right,
forced together by walls that, you know, keep certain things out and keep certain things in. And so if we're trying to understand what community is, that's a significant step forward. And so I think with all of these different ones we've been talking about, right, they're a great place to start. You know, start with the dictionary or start with what you'd point at. What is it not? Do you have any handy, insightful metaphors? And, you know, try to see the meaning stamped into the word. But we're always remembering these words are just conventions. And next time we can actually get at, right, not just words, but the things signified by the words.
Dr. Benjamin Beyer, Associate Professor of Education at Hillsdale College, talking about definition. Dr. Beyer, thanks for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thanks for having me.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to John J. Miller from Hillsdale's Dow Journalism Department, talking about Ronald Reagan as the great communicator. Joshua Mitchell joined us to discuss his latest book, American Awakening. And Ben Beyer from Hillsdale's Education Department continuing his definition
of definition. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spotify, or Amazon Podcasts. Search for The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. You can follow the show on Twitter at Hillsdale Radio or on Facebook. The assistant producer of The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour is Nate Esbenshade. To find out more about Hillsdale College, head to hillsdale.edu. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
It's The Ramsey Show, talk radio where debt is dumb and cash is king. Listen weekdays at noon on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM, your talk radio station.
Alan Gordon, Coachmaster Collision. Although Coachmaster is recognized as the authority and specialist in frame and suspension, we are primarily your auto body and truck collision repair center. This includes all vehicles, Lexus, Honda, or pickup trucks. Our technicians are highly trained and have the most advanced equipment to ensure a complete and quality repair. With our knowledge and the insurance claim process, all we need is your claim number to handle your claim. Coachmaster has a great working relationship with all insurance companies. This ensures a complete repair with quality parts and a delay-free process. At Coachmaster, in our 50 years in business, we've experienced almost every situation imaginable in a claim. This experience and personal dedication to the repair of your vehicle sets Coachmaster apart from all other choices. And yes, if we can't fix it, no one can.
Learn more online at CoachmasterAutobody.com.
Redding Electric Utility cares about the whole community, and we offer an income-qualified residential energy discount program that can save you up to $400 a year on your energy bill. And once per year, CARES bill credit up to $300. To find out if your income qualifies you for a residential discount program and CARES program, call 339-7200. That number again is 339-7200.
Aloha, this is Kevin, operations manager at Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. A professionally cleaned business sends a message to your paying customers. It says you are a company that cares about your image and always presenting the very best impression. Time after time, I've talked to clients who shopped for the lowest price and after a few months realized that their professional image was suffering. They didn't know who was actually coming into their offices to do the cleaning, and they just weren't getting the value they were paying for. Be wary of big-name companies that take your money, then hire unknown contractors to do the work. Since 1987, Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, your local professionals, have been offering the best in office cleaning by our screened, bonded, and insured staff. Take pride in your business and say aloha to your customers with the professional cleaning services from Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. Call 221-5868. 221-5868. MauiBob'sOfficeCleaning.com.
I'm Lee Hull.
And I'm Lee Esses.
And we co-host Writing Roots.
It's a 10-minute podcast in which we, an author,
and her editor,
cover lessons we've learned about the writing process.
Writing Roots is available on iTunes, Spotify, and anywhere you find your podcasts. And don't forget to always
write selfishly.
Some things in life you can just rely on, like the comfy fit of a favorite pair of jeans, and the tried and true performance of a new home comfort system from Rood. So here's to reliability, built into everything we do. Rely on Rood.
Get reliable comfort when the weather turns cold with a new heating system installed by the local pros at Alliance Heating and Air. Call Alliance Heating and Air today at 530-221-2642.
The world is full of obvious things which nobody by any chance ever observes. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Hull.
And I'm Lee Esses.
Before we get started on today's episode, we want your questions. Every December, we talk about specific questions that we receive from you so we can answer them and make sure that we're addressing your specific needs. So if you have a question, contact us, let us know what it is, so we can answer it for you.
There are a couple ways to do that. You can either find us on Facebook, send us a message that way, or of course the email address at the end of this episode is a great way to contact not only your questions, but episode ideas and commentary about how fantastic my voice is.
So let's get into today's episode. What's the topic?
We're talking about using your senses, not just what I see or what I hear, but what I'm tasting, what I'm smelling. This is a common bit of advice you hear from third grade teachers. Make sure you include all five senses in the scene.
The reason why senses are so important is that it immerses the reader into the moment with something that they can connect with that otherwise they wouldn't understand. While most of your readers may not know what, say, a homeless person who lives on the streets most of the time and never gets a shower smells like, you do know what a boy's gym locker room smells like after a day of football practice. These are small little details that you can connect the dots to give them an idea of the senses of what they're seeing, hearing, tasting, because readers want to be in the moment. They want to be in the world, and the senses is how you do that.
Not necessarily strictly smells, although that is a great one to give an idea of environment. But if your character can taste the rain in the air before the storm, that's something your readers can relate to.
So we mentioned earlier the five senses. We're aware that that's probably what you've been taught. That's what we were taught. That's what we were familiar with. But there are so many more senses than just five.
In this particular case, we're talking about ways that we interact with the world, ways that the world gives our brains information. Not necessarily seeing dead people like the sixth sense or an emotional IQ, these other things that are part of the human experience, but literally how you get information from the world.
Physical interactions. The most common that you're going to be using in a book is vision, what they're seeing.
And this tends to be the default for a lot of storytellers because a lot of storytellers also watch TV, also go to the movie theaters. You see and you hear a lot of things in cinema, and therefore when you're seeing the story play out in your head, it's sight and sound based often.
So that's the second sense, is the hearing. Your third is smell. This can be so important. Because people remember smells really well. There are actually studies linking smell with memory. So if you can introduce them to a smell that they are familiar with, you are connecting them with a story on a new level.
Smell is closely intertwined with taste. They're right next to each other on the face, yes, but a lot of the words you're going to use are very similar. That saltiness, that nuttiness. Talk about tea tasting or wine tasting. They will say a perfuminess to the flavor, the bouquet of the wine.
Speaking as someone who has a lot of allergies that affect my sinuses, your smell affects your taste. If I can't smell anything, I really can't taste much. It has to be a very strong flavor for me to taste it.
This particular list has 9 different kinds. We got that list from talkingmatters.com. And what we in kindergarten learned as touch is not only texture, something is soft or silky, but also temperature, something is hot or cold, but also pain.
Which also goes with hot and cold because a lot of pain is associated either with hot or with cold.
Those are all kind of in the touch category, but I wanted to make sure we talked about each of these separately because there are different ways for your character to interpret their environment. It is not only cold, but it is sharp.
You can also have balance as one of the senses. This is really important for characters who, I don't know, maybe are drunk, maybe got drugged, who are usually very graceful and suddenly find themselves tipping and unable to stand up straight.
Also, if your character has motion sickness or, you know, is on a pirate ship, that sense of balance, especially if it's their first time, takes a little while to get your sea legs.
And then
The flip side.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.